KPCC supporters include Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, nominated for four Screen Actors Guild Awards, including actress Frances McDormand, supporting actors Sam Rockwell and Woody Harrelson, and Best Ensemble, awards eligible in all categories.
And Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Shape of Water, nominated for 14 Critics' Choice Awards, including director Guillermo del Toro, actress Sally Hawkins, and Best Picture of the Year. Awards eligible in all categories.
Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by film critics Amy Nicholson, Justin Chang, and Charles Solomon. We start with the animated comedy, along with live action, Paddington 2, starring Ben Whishaw, Hugh Grant, and Sally Hawkins. Paul King directed and co-wrote the screenplay with Simon Farnaby. What do you think, Amy?
I have been looking forward to Paddington 2 ever since the second Paddington 1. Paddington 1 was just the marvelous, most charming movie I'd seen in forever, and Paddington 2 doubles down on it. We were talking right before we went on about the Great British Bake Off, and watching the Paddington series is like living in the land of the Great British Bake Off. There's marmalade, and people are happy, and everyone's eating jam. And, you know, Paddington, as you recall, is a bear from deepest, darkest Peru. And the sequel really leans into this idea that it's an immigrant story, kind of like what your last segment was about, where there are people in the neighborhood who don't like him because of who he is and where he's from. And through a series of events in the opening part of the movie, he winds up imprisoned for something he didn't do. And the movie takes that semi-seriously while making it also really sweet, really charming, really wonderful. I adore this franchise, and at the end, Justin and I were both quietly crying in our seats.
You've got me worried now about Paddington.
As Amy says, there's kind of a nice little anti-Brexit subtext to this movie. It's timely as well as just charming as all get out. The thing I love about these movies is that there's this old-fashioned feeling to them in the best sense, I think, in which there's this beautifully worked out comic structure, you know, gags that are planted early on that you know are going to pay off, and they do, and sometimes that drives me crazy, but here, for some reason, in this context, it doesn't. It feels as if people have taken care with the craftsmanship of the script, and I think Paul King, and there's some exquisite direction in this film. You know, I go up and down with Wes Anderson, and I think that this film has partakes of his aesthetic in a really lovely way. That prison sequence feels almost like a direct copy of what we saw in the Grand Budapest Hotel, and yeah, it's almost just too daft and delightful to give away what happens there. I will say you actually do learn how to make marmalade. He runs through the recipe and has to
actually,
create.
Actually, it wouldn't work from that recipe. I've made marmalade,
so it's historically inaccurate. You know, but,
which we're going to talk about later on the program. How accurate do historical dramas or Paddington have to be? What do you think, Charles?
I call in from Slytherin here because I didn't particularly like the movie. I think it is very derivative. There are pieces and bits from other films in here, from Theater of Blood, from Modern Times, from The Producers, from Ratatouille, from Toy Story 2.
All great films.
Yes, but I don't know that they've taken things from them that well. Hugh Grant, who is the nutty villain, wants to stay, you know, is trying to find a treasure so he can stage his one-man review, and they have him singing Rain on the Roof, a very minor song from Follies, where he should be doing The Lullaby of Broadway or Anything Goes or No Business Like Show Business. He's singing a duet by himself. And that it's that kind of inattention to detail that bothers me.
But doesn't that speak to the fact that his character is a giant egomaniac who plays eight different people and talks to himself constantly?
Well, he also plays one of the nuns in St. Paul's Cathedral, which is an Episcopalian church and has never had nuns in it.
But it does,
I'm troubled by these
things. You know, it does make room for this great sequence where they said, like, what happened? And somebody says, a nun went berserk. And somebody, without missing a beat, another person says, it happens. You know, so it's worth it for that exchange.
So you're worried people will be misdirected on their understanding?
Well, also, and the animation of Paddington is primarily performance capture. So he doesn't, his proportions are sometimes too human when he's doing certain physical actions. His legs look too long because they have to compensate. Again, it didn't charm me, but, you know, it charmed them.
All right. Yeah, so today you are outvoted on this one because you two really loved it.
Love this movie.
Yeah, it feels like watching a childhood classic in real time. It feels like you're just watching a thing that kids are going to love for the next 50 years.
Do you need to see Paddington, the first one, to appreciate Paddington 2?
No. And especially since this one actually opens with a flashback to his Peruvian upbringing.
Which also opened the first one, didn't it?
It did also. So in a way, it's kind of going back. So it catches you up to speed.
So it stands on its own two paws.
Yes. Yes.
Paddington 2 in wide release. Paul King is the director. It's rated PG. The Commuter with Liam Neeson starring, as every year this time of year, he does one of these thrillers. The film also starring Vera Farmiga. It's directed by Jolette Serra and co-written by Byron Willinger, Phil de Blasi, and Ryan Engel. Justin?
Yeah, this director and Liam Neeson have made a couple. This is their fourth collaboration after Unknown, Nonstop, and Run All Night. These movies are very erratic. At the same time, they all kind of afford a certain amount of pleasure, usually just the sight of Liam Neeson, kicking the you-know-what-about out of somebody or something, not in quite the same way that he does in the Taken movies, but here, it's interesting, in this film, he's actually playing someone who, while is an ex-NYPD cop, is not some, just killing machine. He's actually, and now he sells life insurance, and he finds himself on this commuter train from Manhattan to Westchester County, and where he lives, and he's just lost his job. There's actually a really nifty sequence, I think, at the very start of this movie where it shows you just how long he and his wife and his child have gone through their daily routine. So it's very much a movie about just kind of the routine nature of life. And suddenly something is not so routine, because on this commuter train, he's approached by Vera Farmiga and all her kind of silky, sinuous, insinuating brilliance. And she kind of gives him this assignment saying, you have to find someone on this train who does not belong. And tag that person for us, otherwise, and insinuates that something is going to happen to your wife and child. So this is kind of a classic Hitchcockian wrong man thriller with elements of, like, we just had a remake of Murder on the Orient Express. This one also has elements of, like, The Lady Vanishes. It held me for about the first half, and then I think it runs off the rails.
I'm
sorry.
I knew you were going to say that.
How can you not say it?
I tried to stop.
It's kind of fun to see something this sort of hokey, and there's some very inventive filmmaking sometimes in terms of just how the train stays in motion, with the cameras running all over the place as Liam Neeson's just running and chugging from one car to the next and, going underneath the boards of the train. It's, it's that kind of movie.
Amy? When you started to compare it to The Lady Vanishes, I was like, settle down now, Justin. Tell the truth about this film.
It's not a qualitative comparison.
This film has a central conceit in it that I just couldn't get over, where it's this all-powerful group who are trying to keep Liam Neeson in motion on the train. They can see basically everything he's doing. They know every single thing he's doing. And yet they can't find this one person. Yes. And you're like, you could find that in a heartbeat. If you are this powerful, you don't even need Liam Neeson. None of this makes any sense. And I'm trying not to pull a Charles Solomon and have this one thing take me out of the movie.
Boy, did my ticket get punched.
But I could not get over that. I mean, this movie is trying, I think, very hard to be somewhat relevant. There's a scene where Liam Neeson gives the finger to a banker who works at Goldman Sachs. And I enjoyed its efforts at trying to talk about the working man getting pushed out of the job at 60, needing money desperately, mortgages. It's really trying to build itself into the framework of the housing crisis to try to justify the fact that we have a fourth Liam Neeson destroying people in a moving vehicle film. I thought it was so underwhelming, but I did enjoy a couple of the action scenes, as Justin is saying. There's one that's kind of a feigned single take. I don't think it actually is. Hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah.
That's pretty great. There's a couple of scenes where he nearly gets his head clobbered by another train or the tracks that were fantastic, but we don't need these.
It goes on way too long as well, and by the end, just when they should be wrapping up, they drag it out so that the movie doesn't accelerate as well as it should. And
oh,
so,
Justin, was that?
That was not even. Sometimes that was just me describing.
All right,
the movie.
Everybody, Amy, it's your turn to get one of these in. So Neeson is—he's 65. You never used to see someone at this age doing these kind of very physical action thing. But I don't think he's the first at in this age category to do it. So how long do
Jackie
you think
Chan
he can keep doing?
And Harrison Ford.
Yeah, that's true. Ford was doing this. Yeah.
Bruce Willis, in one of the Die Hard movies, Live Free or Die Hard, where they kind of engage this kind of, you know, okay, what aging does and kind of how you deal as an action star with the
entire
of aging.
Expendables franchise. Yeah. Stallone can't stop looking at himself
Geezer
like he's King Lear.
Can be in
yeah,
the
wasn't
genre.
Helen Mirren kicking some butt at 70 in one of the films she did not long ago? So.
Oh, yeah. And Helen Mirren in Shadowboxer, a movie that has notes of a film we're going to be talking about later.
All right. So we're talking about The Commuter starring Liam Neeson. It's rated PG-13 in wide release. In Between, Israeli film that's written and directed by Maysoon Hamoud. It's a feature directorial debut, also written by the director. Amy, what'd you think?
I really enjoyed this. If people want to take a gamble on a quality foreign film this weekend, I would highly recommend In Between. It's about three Palestinian women living in Tel Aviv. Two of them are kind of out there. One of them has tattoos everywhere, and she's a DJ. The other one is a really ballsy lawyer who does tons of drugs throughout the film, and she's always getting drunk and making bad decisions. And then a religious cousin moves into there. It's a cousin of a friend of theirs who's just left to get married, and she's engaged to a fiancé who's kind of boring and doesn't treat her very well. And these three women just sort of live their own narratives separately for the most part, where they're dealing with sexism and they're dealing with people in Tel Aviv not wanting them to speak Arabic even when they're working in the back of a kitchen, with people not taking them seriously. But at the same time, you know, it just feels very like lived in and full and quality and full of life. And the moments where they come together and lift each other up are always really sweet. Like, I found myself absolutely knocked out by this. You know, it's a small but really terrific film, I found.
What do you think, Justin?
I really enjoyed it, too, for all the reasons Amy says. I mean, you just don't see that. I mean, I'm trying to think of kind of an analog to this. It's like, can you think of it as like a Sex in the City in Tel Aviv or a girl's kind of, you know, and it has elements of those. What's lovely about it, too, is that you have these three young women of different, you know, and there's different religious backgrounds, too. You know, the cousin who moves in is you know, comes from a strict Muslim family. And I think one of the others comes from a Christian family. And all of them have trouble you know, pleasing their families and living up to, you know, the expectations of them and kind of push back against that kind of patriarchal repression in different ways. You would almost expect them to play up kind of the clash between, I guess, you know, her name is Noor, the Muslim, and the other two, because she's definitely much more conservative than they are. But the sense of sisterhood that develops between them and the way they come to her aid in a way that really becomes a kind of an interesting, you know, somewhat melodramatic subplot in the second half, it's pretty captivating. And you just you don't see lives like this every day, and it's worth. You'd almost recommend a movie about characters like this, even one that was less well done than this one is.
Do you get a sense of Tel Aviv in the film, or is this more an interior movie?
It's kind of both. I think you get a nice sense of, as you know, Amy was saying, the rave scene, the drug scene. It's all of that is very flashy and in the background. But a lot of it also just plays out in their apartment. A lot of it plays out in the hometowns that they're from. You know, kind of, you know, outside Tel Aviv and across, you know, checkpoints or whatever. So yeah.
All right. So both recommend In Between highly, sounds like. It's an Israeli film written and directed by Maysoon Hamoud. It's unrated. It's at the Lemley Fine Arts Theater in Beverly Hills. Also out this week, Jack Black stars as the local polka legend from Pennsylvania, Jan or Jan Lewin, depending on what period of his life, how he pronounces it. The biographical comedy is written and directed by Maya Forbes and Wallace Wolodarski. Justin?
I don't think this is a great movie by any stretch, or maybe even a very good one, but it's one that I sort of enjoyed, just because I do think Jack Black does this kind of con artist character very well. You know, whether he was in School of Rock or Bernie, you know, both of those directed by Richard Linklater, and Bernie was based on a true story, and so is this one. You know, this character Jan or Jan, and he does answer to them interchangeably, which kind of gives you a sense of his good naturedness, but also his shiftiness. You know, and so, you know, lives in Hazleton, Pennsylvania. The movie's like set in the 1990s. He's married to Jenny Slate, who's this very supportive wife, and they have a son, mother-in-law, played by a pretty spectacular Jackie Weaver, who just is suspicious of everything he does, has nothing nice to say about him, and he's so good-natured anyways.
This is the year of the great mother performance already in 2018. I was thinking of the Tanya Harding.
Alice and Janney, and, you know, who just won a Critics' Choice Award last night.
Was it something, the worst thing or whatever, the comedy where I think it's Holly Hunter is the mother who's so good.
Oh, the Big Sick, yeah.
The Big Sick.
The Big Sick, I, Tanya. So we've had a lot of these.
Laurie Metcalf and Lady Bird. It's overbearing mothers are always in season in real life or in cinema. What can I say?
And for great actors, it's a great opportunity. We'll continue with our review of The Polka King, starring Jack Black, Jenny Slate, and Jackie Weaver, a film co-written, co-directed by Maya Forbes and Wallace Wolodarski. We'll find out more what Justin thinks about it and get Amy's take on The Polka King as well, which is streaming on Netflix starting today. It's Film Week coming your way every Friday at 11 live and every Saturday at noon right here on 89.3 KPCC. You can also download the podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And please review the program as well. We'll be back in 1 minute. Justin's making more bad puns here in our Film Week studio.
That's what happens when you listen to the polka.
There is no such thing as a bad pun.
Justin Chang, film critic for the Los Angeles Times, with us. Amy Nicholson, film critic hosting the Canon podcast, and Charles Solomon, film critic for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. In case you joined us late, we remind you the podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen to kpcc.org. We're talking about The Polka King, which is based on a real polka legend from Pennsylvania, Jan or Jan Lewin, who ran afoul of the law. Jack Black plays him. Jenny Slate, Jackie Weaver are in the cast. Justin, we'll come back to you for more of your thoughts, but let's hear what Amy thought of the film.
Yeah, I mean, this just feels like a classic Jack Black film that could have arrived in theaters in 1998. It could have arrived in 2008. It feels beyond its time in a way that made me almost wonder, have standards in comedy changed? Because I wasn't laughing as much as I felt like I should be at this kind of a Jack Black movie. It felt really dated in a way that surprised me as I was watching it. What's interesting about the real-life story of this polka legend, Jan Lewin, whose wife, who's here played by Jenny Slate, winds up running from Miss Pennsylvania while they're together, which is very true. They show pictures at the end of it, is that his story is so bizarre and so interesting that I almost wish Jack Black had just played it straight like a dramedy, because that would have completely worked. I mean, he plays it large and comedic, and it doesn't need that. It overinflates this movie, and for me, that made it feel lifeless, really.
And, you know, in a way, maybe it is kind of in that in-between zone, because I didn't find this movie laugh out loud funny either, but I was sort of continually interested in it as it went along. And basically, the thing is, he ran this Ponzi scheme based on his fans, because, you know, he was making no money from his polka gigs, and, you know, and with the mother-in-law kind of railing against him, and he was trying to provide for his family. And so, you know, he starts scamming his own customers, and just snowballs from there. And there's this like the surreal episode where come and enjoy our premium Pope package, where they go to like Rome to go meet the Pope. And what happens there is just so strange. It almost like it had to happen this way, because they almost don't explain what happens. And so you get the sense of this, they really did have a fascinating story on their hands, and maybe they didn't hit the right, you know, quite all the right beats to tell it, but it's kind of fascinating all the same.
Yeah, I mean, if there's a theme to this week, it's also very much an immigrant story. It's about him trying to chase his American dream. And when things like the Rome sequence happen, you get the sense that he has been watching too much Oprah, deeply believes in the secret, and he's willing it to happen. And you can't deny that it did. There's something interesting there. Justin's correct.
The Polka King, starring Jack Black. You can see it on Netflix. It's unrated. The Insult is Lebanon's submission for Best Foreign Language Oscar. It's directed by Ziad Douary, who also co-wrote the screenplay. Justin?
The immigrant theme continues with this film, actually. And I think the most valuable... most valuable thing about this film is the picture that it gives you about kind of inter-Arab tensions within the city of Beirut. This is a movie that, as its title suggests, starts off with an insult, a spat that occurs between two men who are very different. One of them is a Lebanese Christian, a local, you know, who's lived there for most of his life. And the other is an older Palestinian man who we later learn is a refugee. And so... the Palestinian man is a foreman who is tasked with making building repairs in the neighborhood, and is trying to repair this illegally installed drain pipe on this Lebanese man's property. And right from the get-go, there's this tension between them, and the Lebanese man doesn't want him to fix the pipe. And it just escalates from there. Words are exchanged. Physical blows are ultimately exchanged. It becomes this protracted legal battle, a protracted media firestorm. And so it's sort of using this story to shed light on the tinderbox of Middle East politics and wounds that have not been healed since, you know, the Lebanese Civil War, which was took place from 1975 to 1990, a 15-year sectarian conflict whose kind of legacy is affecting both of these men to this very day. So this is very much a movie, you know, it's fascinating on that level. You know, it's a very angry film. I frankly found it a little too shouty, a little too kind of I found it devoid of a certain level of nuance. But it's very, very much entertaining because kind of a law and order structure, which tells you something about Middle Eastern politics today.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch the story grow and grow and grow beyond these two men in this one pipe and become basically a Fox News story where everybody's shouting at each other from different divides. You know, it really triggers this firestorm in the neighborhood. To me, where it went a little wrong is once you get to the courtroom, there's a lawyer character who is so one-dimensional that it throws off the balance. It felt like they're exploring something really interesting because both of these men are right. Both of these men are wrong. One of them is a lot more wrong than the other one, but they both are founded in this stubbornness and this pride that's not going to let either one give an inch. And so in a way, it's also this exploration of that kind of masculinity where neither one can apologize. They just can't. They won't do it. They refuse. And then this lawyer comes in who's such a snake in the grass that the film, I think, shows its cards too early and then it goes on too long. And it was disappointing because there's a lot of greatness in there. I feel like this film is likely to get one of the five foreign film, foreign language nominations.
I think so, too. And it's, I think it's because it's very slick in its presentation. And I do have a problem with that, I think, for exactly the reason that lawyer character. There's something where you almost feel like this movie should be capturing this rawness, this kind of, it should come out, and it just feels a little too manipulated for me.
The insult is the film from Lebanon, the country's submission for Best Foreign Language Office Oscar. It's rated R. You can see it at Lemley's Royal in West L.A. Saturday Church, a dramatic musical written and directed by Damon Cardasis. Justin?
It's about a 14-year-old kid from the Bronx. He's gay. He's black. I think this movie is, you know, we had Moonlight last year, and so this is kind of a flawed but welcome contribution to stories about black LGBT people. And, you know, and it's very interesting, and I don't think these numbers are all successful, but I kind of enjoyed the impulse behind the musical numbers that we see. You know, he is bullied at school by the guys in the locker room. He is, you know, he's recently just lost his father. And so his aunt, who's this very sort of strict, conservative Christian woman who, you know, is trying to kind of, like, I guess, you know,
battle axe is a term that comes to mind.
Charles always there with the proper term. And so, you know, and there are these musical numbers where he is, which kind of open up this realm of fantasy and also for self-expression. In some ways, this movie feels like a narrative companion piece to this documentary we saw last year, Kiki, which was about the voguing scene in New York and about the community that LGBT teenagers find. And he does eventually find that space and people like himself that he can bond with. And, you know, it's kind of damning a film with faint praise sometimes to say that it has its heart in the right place. I think this is a better movie than that, but even though it hews to kind of a conventional structure.
Charles, what do you think?
I think I agree mostly with Justin that this is interesting but flawed. Although he's supposedly very much under the thumb of this aunt and his mother, and he's got a brother who could work for the Stasi who keeps such careful tabs on him, yet he can still go out Saturday night for hours and hours and disappear into this netherworld. The one place where I part company with Justin is on the musical numbers, which I just don't think the performers are strong enough to bring them on. You know, the kids, when I got picked on in gym class, they didn't dance. And if they did, I would hope they would have danced better than these people do.
If you'd gone to the high school for the performing arts, maybe that
maybe. But he doesn't either. So while I think it's well-intended and, again, is opening up subject matter that is often ignored, you look at it and wish it were better.
Amy?
Well, it's the first film from this filmmaker, Damon Cardasis. And I feel like it's going to be a film where when he makes five films, we're going to look back at this and say, oh, we really saw his potential. Because I love the musical numbers and I prefer clumsy dancers because to me, a clumsy dancer in a film has more life to them. I relate to that even better. I mean, if you can't have Gene Kelly, give me somebody who's a little bit off. Give me somebody who's a little shambling. And I just wish there had been more musical numbers because this film starts off very slow, kind of like your ordinary small drama. And the first musical number that really knocks you over is when he's in his locker room. There's these blue lockers. There's these kids in yellow gym shirts. It's suddenly this bright, crazy, gorgeous musical. And it took, I think, 20 minutes to get there. And I wish there had been double the musical numbers. I wish they had just really leaned into it.
Saturday Church, the film we're talking about, written and directed by Damon Kardasis. Luke Kane, Margot Bingham, Regina Taylor star. It's unrated, and you can see it at the Arena Cine Lounge in Hollywood. Proud Mary stars Taraji P. Henson, Billy Brown, and Danny Glover. Babak Najafi is the director. Steve Anton, John Stewart Newman, Christian Swegel are the screenwriters. Amy?
Yeah, I love Taraji P. Henson, and I was so excited to see her play a tough
character. Hidden Figures,
in
she was great.
Empire, I'm a big Empire fan. Here, she's playing a hit woman who, in the opening scene, kills her target, then realizes he has a 10-year-old boy, and then a year later keeps tabs on this boy and realizes she needs to take him in herself, free him from this Fagin-esque character he's working for, and adopt him, which sets off an insane chain of violence. I mean, this is the kind of film where there are so many bullets, you start wondering, does Boston, where this is set, have any policemen? Of any reality. You know, it's a real disappointment to me because the film opens very strong, like very Pam Grier-esque. She's doing push-ups on the floor and fixing her makeup and she's wonderful. And then she immediately just turns into this droning Bruce Willis character who doesn't smile, doesn't crack any jokes. The film takes no advantage of the fact that this is Taraji P. Henson. You know, we love her because she's got this fierce intelligence. They take away the intelligence. She's just fear. She's just machine gunning people and occasionally dropping a quip. It's such a waste of what she can do. She has all this charisma that's not here on the screen.
Proud Mary is the film. It's unrated in wide release. Now, we have a number of prominent year-end films that were very limited in where you could see them that are now going far wider. That includes Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, starring Frances McDormand, Woody Harrelson, Sam Rockwell, Martin McDonagh, the writer-director. Amy, you want to give your endorsement for this? Or
yeah,
not.
I do. I think Three Billboards has become our flashpoint argumentative film, if you're on film Twitter too much, which I am. I understand a lot of the complaints about it, but to me, Three Billboards is this great film about empathy, where people make mistakes, where you're not supposed to be rooting for any character all along the way. But this is a terrific performance by Frances McDormand and Woody Harrelson, who I feel like has not been getting enough talk about.
Justin, quick comment on this.
Sam Rockwell has been kind of getting the awards momentum for
and I
sure.
Think he's the worst in the film.
I mean, I have to say, it is polarizing. I like this film more the first time I saw it than the second time I did because I do think that there are, I hate the word problematic, but sometimes there's no other word for it, elements in terms of its treatment of race and about the black characters in this movie. But I think the performances hold you and the writing does hold you so much that I have to admit I kind of missed those things the first time.
Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri is rated R in selected theaters. The Post, of course, going wide this week. Meryl Streep, Tom Hanks star, Steven Spielberg direct, Liz Hanna, Josh Singer. Charles, a quick thought on The Post?
Liked it, didn't love it. I think it doesn't hold up against a Spotlight from last year that was so strong. Perhaps because they're playing catch up on the story to the New York Times, they're not really breaking it. But I mean, certainly a well-made movie, but didn't excite me.
The story of the Pentagon Papers, of course, Amy.
Yeah, it's such a classic film as well. To me, where this film really has its roots is just in Meryl Streep's character of Katharine Graham. It's almost less about the journalism and more about a woman finding herself and really putting her company and her entire fortune and her family name on the line. There's a scene where she's on the phone and makes a big decision that I know Meryl Streep's probably not going to win an Oscar this year because we're almost tired of giving her awards, but it's really terrific.
She does give her best performance in a very long time. I agree with Charles. It's not the great portrait of journalism in action that Spotlight was. In some ways, it's a portrait of kind of an extraordinary, anomalous moment in a newsroom. But Spielberg kind of does direct the hell out of it. Just, I mean, there's such a kinetic kind of kick to it that it's almost more, it's not a great film about journalism, but it's a pretty entertaining one.
With quite a cast.
Yes.
The Post is the film. Steven Spielberg, quite a director as well. It's rated PG-13. It's gone much wider this week. You can check your local listings for the theater near you. When we come back after the update, we'll talk about Phantom Thread, which is Paul Thomas Anderson's new film. It, too, is going wider. And Darkest Hour, starring Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill, Joe Wright's film. So we'll hear more about those, and we'll also talk about films that are historic, such as some of the ones we're talking about here. How important is it that those films be historically authentic, or what liberties should filmmakers feel they can take? We'll be back on Film Week after this update.
Mm-hmm.
KPCC supporters include Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, nominated for 4 Screen Actors Guild Awards, including actress Frances McDormand, supporting actors Sam Rockwell and Woody Harrelson, and Best Ensemble. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Awards eligible in all categories, including this original score by Carter Burwell.
And Fox Searchlight Pictures presenting The Shape of Water. Nominated for 14 Critics' Choice Awards, including Master Storyteller and Director Guillermo del Toro, Actress Sally Hawkins, and Best Picture of the Year, The Shape of Water, an otherworldly fairy tale set against the backdrop of Cold War-era America circa 1962. In the hidden high-security government laboratory where she works, lonely Elisa, Sally Hawkins, is trapped in a life of isolation. Elisa's life is changed forever when she and co-worker Zelda, Octavia Spencer, discover a secret classified experiment. Awards eligible in all categories, including this original score by Alexandre Desplat, now playing.
Good to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Our critics this week are Charles Solomon, Justin Chang, and Amy Nicholson. Right now, we're talking about some of the films that have been out on one or two screens in Southern California. They were released before year's end to qualify for Oscar consideration. Now you're going to have a much better chance to see them throughout Southern California. One of those, Phantom Thread, written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson. Amy?
Yeah, Phantom Thread is a really curious, small, lovely look at relationships, particularly slightly twisted ones, or the ones where your quirks fit together in a way that doesn't make sense to anybody else except the two of you. You know, it's directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, and I almost wouldn't have guessed it was. It doesn't feel like a Paul Thomas Anderson for much of the film until there's a couple bleak moments where you're like, oh, that would be him. That is his sense of humor that I finally see in this film. But it stars Daniel Day-Lewis as a dressmaker who makes these couture, like Shantung dresses, just for the very, very wealthy in London. He has a type of girl he usually falls for and then swaps out interchangeably, almost like a needle or thread. He dumps one at the start, picks up another one who's a waitress, and she tends to look like everybody else but be stubborn in her own way and fit him in ways that nobody can understand. I mean, this is the sort of film that really drills down on things that bother you in a relationship, like the way his partner butters toast. The way she butters toast just becomes almost like anybody else waving a gun in a kitchen.
The really funny joke about the sound design where he amplifies the scrape of the knife on the toast. That's great.
We should mention Vicky Krieps is the co-star of the film.
Yes, and I think one of the reasons it doesn't feel like a Paul Thomas Anderson film in some respects is because it's set in 1950s London, and his films have usually been set mostly in California, but certainly in the U.S., I think this movie's a masterpiece. I think and absolutely one of my favorite films of last year. I could have watched just the way Paul Thomas Anderson guides you into this world that you feel has been just created from scratch. It is just transporting. If the movie had just been nothing but dressmaking for 2 hours, I would have watched transfixed just to see the camera movements and the music, this gorgeous score by Johnny Greenwood, who he's been collaborating with for so long. But you get this incredible psychodrama, dark comedy about marriage. Between Vicky Krieps and Daniel Day-Lewis, this has been said it's going to be his last film. We'll see if that holds true. I hope not. And I want to say a word about Leslie Manville, who is just brilliant. Every shot of her in this movie is like amazing. She plays his sister and his very, you know, who is, you know, just the taskmaster, complete icy control over this household. And she's channeling Judith Anderson as Mrs. Danvers in Hitchcock's Rebecca. And it's one of the great performances and one of the many great pleasures of this movie.
Wow. Phantom Thread, high praise from our critics, going wider this week into many more theaters in Southern California. Daniel Day-Lewis, Vicky Krieps star, Paul Thomas Anderson, the writer-director, and Phantom Thread is rated R. And finally, Darkest Hour, which is going into wider release. Gary Oldman stars as Winston Churchill. This sort of the other side of Dunkirk, which came out earlier last year. Joe Wright here is the director, Anthony McCartney
Patton is the screenwriter. Justin?
This movie basically exists as a showcase for Gary Oldman's kind of marvelously scenery-chewing performance. This is not my favorite acting by a long shot, but Gary Oldman doing Winston Churchill, not an intuitive choice of actor and character necessarily also, but he acts the hell out of it. And this is a portrait of him. You know, we're obviously in Churchill season with shows like The Crown. There was actually a Churchill biopic starring Brian Cox earlier this, you know, last year, I believe. And here he's, you know, staring down Nazi Germany as you know, in the early days of World War II, and he alone is holding firm while everyone else wants to kind of submit to Neville Chamberlain's appeasement policy. So, you know, it's compelling. It's, you know, very theatrically directed. I think there's a certain ham-fisted quality to this movie, though, that I didn't care for.
Yeah, what'd you think, Amy?
Yeah, it feels like the sort of film that would have waltzed in and won Oscars in 1995. I like that Gary Oldman has no book in his career. He starts off playing Sid Vicious, and now he's Winston Churchill. I mean, that is a range.
Yes.
It's, to me, one of the more interesting elements of it is it really does drill down on this idea that we could have lost World War II, that there were small negotiations that made sense and that what he wanted to do didn't make sense. And to pair this with Dunkirk as that kind of two sides of the coin to see what was happening in the deepest, darkest bowels of the buildings where Winston Churchill is working to be safe from bombs and negotiations that were happening are really interesting. One of my favorite scenes in here is when he just calculates the loss of life they're willing to take. And it's very brutal. And you realize that these are decisions no leader wants to have to do. And he makes them and he does them. And it's not a fun portrait of leadership at all. I don't love this film, but I enjoy it for what it is. You know, it feels like a good brown bread and butter sandwich, I suppose. I don't.
But not toast.
But not toast. Not toast.
So funny. Now I'm thinking back to Sid and Nancy, although I have like a split screen in my head with Gary Oldman. So different. Oldman here in Darkest Hour stars as Winston Churchill. It's rated PG-13. Joe Wright directs, and it's in selected theaters, but many more of them. It's gone much wider this week. It, of course, a historical drama. Just like The Post, just like so many others that we had in 2017 and here early in 2018. So my question for you, if you're listening live on Friday during our 11 o'clock hour broadcast of Film Week, is to call us and let us know which films, when they dealt with historic themes, you particularly gave latitude to, even if you knew it wasn't accurate, but it just was so compelling and maybe told the story even despite its inaccuracies, or if there were cases where they got it so wrong you could not forgive it, and it just took you out of the drama of the film. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. If you're listening Friday or Saturday or via the podcast, you can comment also on our Film Week segment page at kpecc.org. Charles, let me start with you, because so many of the great animated films deal with historic events.
True. I was actually going to fuss about a couple of live action movies,
oh, okay.
But if you'd rather talk about animation, I'm...
No. Do the live action, then we'll get to the great Japanese films and tell history.
No, one that last year that particularly bothered me was The Death of Louis XIV, which is something that many fellow critics loved. But if you read Saint-Simon's memoirs, in which it's partially based, this isn't what happened at all. The poor king in this is sort of bored to death by himself when, in fact, he was meeting with his illegitimate sons and planning the future of the regime that would succeed him. But for the all-time I could never forgive them, there's Amadeus. And unfortunately, there are now, I think, a lot of people in this country who believe that Mozart was the idiotic twit depicted in that movie and that the milieu he moved in was like that, when, in fact, if you read the memoirs of that period, people referred to Mozart as the Austrian Orpheus. They were in awe of that talent, and he was not without friends, including not only Franz Joseph Haydn, but the Esterházys, who were a Hungarian princely family who were so rich, they had their own opera house at their estate.
But for many people, a highly entertaining film was made that, while it might have had nothing to do with the real personality, character of Mozart, was a compelling film. Is that wrong to use a named historic figure and then portray them entirely differently?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to make a fantasy, make a fantasy. But that wasn't what Mozart was like, even down to details. They turn the Queen of the Night into his mother-in-law is nagging him, and she becomes the Queen of the Night singing one of her two big arias in the Magic Flute. And that's actually a caricature of Maria Theresa, whom Mozart disapproved of because of her anti-Masonic policies. So he turned the Empress into the villainess.
Norman Lakewood responding says, I think Amadeus is a great example. Does anyone really expect it's totally accurate? I doubt it. I see Greatest Showman being like that, but somehow everyone thinks it should be accurate. More serious films should be more accurate. Sometimes they just change details that make no sense, and that's annoying. And I agree with that. What bothers me is when they change historic events for no good reason, when in fact what really happened is perhaps more dramatically interesting or funnier than what ends up being depicted on film. We'll come back and continue because we need to take a break. We'll hear what Amy and Justin have to say about that. Again, if you're listening Friday to the live Air Talk in the 11 o'clock hour, you can call us at when does it particularly bother you? When does it not? When liberties are taken in films that are supposedly historically accurate. And when did you feel like a movie that has a historic setting really nailed it? 866-893-KPECC. We'll continue with our Film Week critics in 1 minute. It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. We're joined by critics Amy Nicholson, Charles Solomon, and Justin Chang. And we're talking about films that attempt to depict history or take great liberties in those historic depictions. How much slack are you willing to give filmmakers when it comes to movies that are at least based on historic events? Or when do you feel like it's truly destructive with the liberties taken? 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Amy, your thoughts on this, or favorite or most disturbing film in the category?
Yeah, thinking about it, I think I have the most problem with the stories that are attempting to tell stories about modern history that people take almost in place of reading in the newspaper. You know, I'm thinking about how almost every January we have this Docbuster that pretends to be the true story of Benghazi or the true story of the American sniper. We have Lone Survivor also in this category. We have a film that I haven't seen yet about the horseback riders, I believe in Afghanistan, the soldiers who ride horses up the mountains with Michael Shannon. And these films act like they are the truth. You know, they come in saying, you know, based on true events. And they're usually really, really wrong. And I feel like they're very politicizing. And what they choose to put in, what they choose to leave out, really distorts the events. And I feel like that's a problem because people accept them as truth, unlike something like, say, Amadeus or The Greatest Showman, which I would have mocked The Greatest Showman, the P.T. Barnum biopic, very heavily the day that I saw it. And I've been listening to the soundtrack nonstop. So I just want to say that there are sing-along screenings this weekend and I will be there.
Justin.
Those, you know, I was just on that. You know, I actually did take The Greatest Showman to task in my review, despite finding a lot of the music really damnably listenable to, because yeah, it does completely.
You're really quote worthy.
Am
today.
I really? Oh, yeah, thank you, Larry. Yeah, appreciate that. Really. I mean, I think because you know it completely gets P.T. Barnum wrong, and it makes him a heroic figure. I mean, he is someone who mocked and encouraged the public's mockery of Black people and the disabled. And but is that movie entertaining in spite of itself? Yes, but I think that sometimes you look at the reasons behind why the filmmakers are making the motivation behind these changes. You know, you look at a film like A Beautiful Mind, where the mathematician John Nash, they completely sort of whitewashed out some unsavory or things that would be perceived as unsavory aspects of his character. And I don't insist on literal or perfect accuracy, but I think in that case, for example, it manifested a very depressing inability to trust the audience and the audience's intelligence. Well,
what was the film about Alan Turing?
The Imitation Game.
Imitation, yeah. Where you had no idea what all that machinery was doing. What they failed to do was explain, how is this a breakthrough? How is he brilliant? Mm-hmm. That's a problem.
Absolutely. Yeah.
By the way, with Charles's notes on Amadeus, I'm terrified of him seeing The Greatest Showman and sitting down when Jenny Lind, the real life Swedish Nightingale, performs and sings a song that could have been on Adele's last album. I think you will have a complete corner.
Let's hear from listeners. Ross in Long Beach, good to have you with us on Film Week.
Thank you.
Oh, I think we just lost him. Go ahead, Ross.
Can you hear me, sir? Yeah. My grandfather, Alexander Frank, since passed away, was a proud World War II veteran. He actually served on D-Day, but all growing up, never talked about it. When Saving Private Ryan came out, I remember he sat my sister and I down, and this was the first time he ever talked about World War II to us, and he said, "This is exactly what it was like." And ever since seeing that opening scene in that movie, you know, we just thought that was a really good depiction of World War II and what it was like for the actual people who were there.
Ross, I appreciate it. I went to a theater to see Saving Private Ryan. It wasn't at an industry screening or anything. And there was a couple that was sitting right in front of me. And it was a definitely older man and certainly was of an age where he could have been a World War II vet. And he was visibly moved by the film, was crying. That's a film that clearly for those of that generation and veterans who served was a very powerful example. I thank you for that. Ross, 866-893-KPCC in Long Beach, joining us. Let's see, Jesse in Van Nuys, welcome.
Yeah, the film that I love watching so much over and over again is JFK, but, you know, for its filmmaking in general. But the film itself is just preposterous because so much of it is so speculative. And for instance, the whole, you know, the main crux of Costner's case in it, that, you know, Kennedy's head could not have gone back into the left, or that it did go back into the left. And so this proves, you know, X and Y about the bullet. And I think it was Penn and Teller that proved that indeed that is how a head would respond. I mean, without getting too graphic.
Yeah. Well, Jesse, let me just, because we have so many people want to comment. But you know, for many people, probably JFK is going to be what stands out in their mind more than all the other historical scholarship that's been done on the JFK assassination. Or another Oliver Stone, Stone film, you know, for how many people is The Doors going to be, you know, representative of The Doors' reality for them as a group? 866-893-KPCC. Rich in Huntington Beach also wanted to, you know, point out how inaccurate in his view Oliver Stone's JFK was, but wanted to praise Spielberg's Lincoln as a great example of a historic film that really got it right. Let's see. Let's talk next with Carol in Koreatown. Welcome, Carol.
Hi, Larry.
Hi.
Hi, Larry.
Go right ahead.
I have one quick comment, not that I'm not a Spielberg fan, but having seen The Post, I don't understand why he changed the persons who helped Daniel Ellsberg copy the Pentagon Papers from his children, who actually did copy the documents, to his friends. That's a major change in history, and I don't understand why he did that.
All right. Carol, I appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, that may fall under the category of changing, if that is true, you know, to something would have been more interesting, perhaps, to have what really occurred. Let's see. Michael in Van Nuys, your thoughts about films purporting to depict history. Michael, you there? No? Let's talk with Ryan in Garden Grove. Welcome.
Hi, thanks, Larry. I was thinking about Gladiator, because that is a almost entirely fictional movie, but it's set against the death of Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius, and about the factors that led to his son Commodus, you know, starting to steer the empire awry. And the character Maximus, the main character, is completely fictional, but he's based on this amalgam of characters that are that were influential to Marcus Aurelius, and of course, slightly based on Spartacus, but it creates, I would say, an exciting and mostly accurate sense of the time, and brings you to that time. And I think even though it's not entirely a historical movie,
yeah,
it's what I consider my favorite historical movie.
How funny, Ryan. I appreciate it very much. Fred, driving on the 405 in West LA. Fred, quick comment.
Yeah, quick comment. I completely disagree with what everybody said about Amadeus. It was a fantasy. It was a depiction of Salieri's image of this completely unworthy individual who was bestowed these extraordinary gifts that he was tremendously jealous of. I didn't think it purported to be a depiction of Mozart, but rather this fevered, hated, you know, jealous image of him.
Yeah, it's interesting. From the Salieri perspective, Fred, I appreciate your call. Thank you all critics for weighing in on this. It's been a lot of fun. Our critics this week on Film Week, Justin Chang of the LA Times, Amy Nicholson of the Canon Podcast, and Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. You can share your comments about historic films, which ones you think got it particularly right, which ones didn't, and which ones you might have found greatly entertaining, even if they weren't historically accurate, on our Film Week page under AirTalk at KPECC.org. Have a wonderful Martin Luther King Jr. weekend. We look forward to your joining us again next week for the next Film Week.